Hello, and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Kaelin McPherson. We begin with, today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with the Underground Railroad Center hosting a Juneteenth Freedom Day celebration. Then labor correspondent Willie Terry brings us part three of the Starbucks Latham store and the importance of the union vote. Later on, we hear from writer and producer of the feature film Sunshine Circle. After that, Angela Beeler about the MDocs program at Skidmore. And finally, we hear a year in review of the Troy's Media Club. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that New York special education preschools are struggling amid funding roadblocks, leading many to close. For some of these preschools, often the only places parents with young, special needs children can get care outside the home, are in desperate financial condition, burning through the year's worth of savings because the state is not covering their actual expenses, the state education department said.
The city of Schenectady's first charter school in over a decade was dealt a significant setback recently when the city planners tabled site plan approval of the proposed downtown location, citing the need for school officials to submit an updated plan outlining student transportation. Parking is a major challenge in the area, and the school has far less the required number of parking spaces.
Albany County officials confirmed a new COVID-19-related death. A man in his 50s has died from the virus. The death toll for Albany County stands at 567 since the outbreak began. There were 62 new infections identified since Thursday and 172 new infections since the last update on Tuesday. The county's seven-day average of new daily positive cases is down to 54.7 from 63.0.
The Gazette reports that the Schenectady City School District launched a new initiative Thursday night with the Spurs partnership with local businesses and organizations to transform the district's schools into community schools. The representative from organizations like the ARC, the Schenectady School Ministries, and the Boys and Girls Club of Schenectady attended a meeting at Liberty to Church to discuss the first steps of building a new community schools within the area.
In Troy, the Local Planning Committee, LPC, will hold the third and final Downtown Revitalization Initiative, that's a DRI, and that community workshop is on Saturday, June 25th, from 1 to 4 p.m. The workshop will focus on how to spend the $10 million in state funding it was awarded to revitalize downtown Troy. The event will be held in person at the Arts Center of the Capital Region, located on 265 River Street.
Capital Roots staff have announced that they are unionizing with SEIU Local 200 United. Over 90% of the staff have signed a union authorization cards. They are requesting voluntary recognition of the union from the CEO, Amy Klein. And that's it for the headlines.
And for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Like what you hear? Find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
You can learn how to contribute. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390. Again, that's 518-272-2390.
And so for our first segment on Saturday, June 18th, the Underground Railroad Education Center at 194 Livingston Avenue in Troy, or in Albany, will host a Juneteenth Freedom Day celebration from noon until 4. Co-founder Paul Stewart discusses the meeting of the Juneteenth and other programs by the center. This is with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We're joined by Paul Stewart, one of the co-founders of the Underground Railroad Education Center in Albany, New York, and they are helping to co-sponsor the second annual Juneteenth Freedom Day celebration and open house, which is going to be on Saturday, June 18th from noon to four. So I know, Paul, we've had you on quite a few times about the Underground Railroad Education Center, but why don't you give people, you know, just sort of a quick, you know, update on it and, you know, why are you organizing around the Juneteenth Freedom Day celebration?
Well, the Underground Railroad Education Center is a nonprofit organization. It's founded about 22 years ago, really, initially as the Underground Railroad History Project, and then a few years ago, renamed as the Underground Railroad Education Center. The purpose of the center is to re-explore and re-examine the story of the Underground Railroad from a different angle, I think, than what people usually think of it. And it's almost a subtle thing because people often don't think very hard about the Underground Railroad story. There's really a lot that can be addressed with it. And there's a lot about it that ties it to our contemporary times as well. So we examine the Underground Railroad story kind of with an eye first toward what's the local story here in the capital region, Albany, Schenectady, Troy, who were the people who came here as freedom seekers, who were the people who helped them, the activists who were involved, both the African-Americans and the non-African-Americans who were involved. And, you know, what did they do and how did they do it? And to look at all this through the eyes of documentation, which is something that people often don't do. They kind of use conflated stories that are passed on or folk tales or things like that. They don't stick too much to hard documented evidence. And that's what we try to do.
So I understand that this particular event, at least on your end, is being done by your teen participants and your young Abolitionist Leadership Institute, and you're providing a day of food, community, and history. Yeah. So what is the Young Abolitionist?
So we've been doing this for a number of years, the Young Abolitionist Leadership Institute, and that is a program that kind of mobilizes teens to look at the history and to try to take an active role in telling the story and using the researched, documented story that we've identified. And so the program actually takes two different forms. There's 5 weeks during the summer when we have about 20 or 30 teens, probably about 30 this coming summer, who come to the Myers residence as a work site in connection with the summer youth employment program. And while here at the work site, they engage in a different kind of work format. That is to say, instead of telling them, you know, pick up these papers, do this yard work, whatever, we try to create a significant space for them to say, what do you want to accomplish within a, you know, to leave behind a sort of legacy project that other people can learn from. You know, we have a focus group facilitator that tries to help keep them on track, and they can set their own timeline and accomplish within 5 weeks, you know, whatever they have selected to do. Now, they usually do something in the area of the arts or possibly archaeology, possibly video. Kids have done, they've done games. We had several students a couple of years ago that did a book called How Not to Die, which you could, about youth health concerns, and you can get that off of Amazon. And the proceeds from that come back to the project. So it was 100 page book. So that's something which I was very impressed with. And then also, you know, we've had some young people do games related to this history, do theatrical performances, music performances. So they really had done a host of different kinds of things. So but that's 5 weeks. And then we also have a spring and a fall component, kind of coinciding a little bit with the school year. And those young people try to work on a variety of different things. And we've got two groups operating right now, one that's focusing on entrepreneurship and one that's working on the subject, what to do with Phil, kind of as a in connection with a request from the Albany mayor's office to have the young people take a look at the Philip Schuyler statue and the disposition of that statue, because some employees who come to City Hall feel uncomfortable that Philip Schuyler was a slaveholder, and he was certainly one of the largest slaveholders in the area during the Revolutionary War period and the years that followed. And so, you know, looking at the various statues around the country that have gone up in relation to Confederate war heroes and slaveholders, et cetera, you know, there's a concern that maybe that statue ought not to be in front of City Hall. So they're looking at that question. They're looking at the history of it, the documentation behind it, this, you know, how it came to be and what the time period was in which it happened, and, you know, other factors related to it. And we hope to render a report to the mayor's office fairly soon.
Now, you know, the Underground Railroad, of course, is very connected to, you know, the fight to abolish slavery. And, you know, that is, you know, what Juneteenth, you know, largely celebrates or observes. But so, but how does, what particular, I don't know, relationship do you see the Underground Railroad movement having with Juneteenth?
Well, Juneteenth, in one respect, is kind of the culmination of the various things that were happening prior to the Civil War. You know, the abolitionist movement, the Underground Railroad movement, and finally, of course, the engagement of the Civil War and the creation, as it were, of the freedmen as a class of people within the country. And then, of course, coming to Juneteenth as the end of the war. But so in that respect, you know, that's important. It's also, broadly speaking, an African-American holiday celebration of freedom. And I think in that respect, we are you know, very interested in engaging with it and celebrating it. We do think of it in terms of it being part of a progression. Very early on, people pretty widely celebrated Emancipation Day at the end of August, which was the time, or excuse me, the beginning of August, which was the time when the British Empire ended slavery in its colonies in the Western Hemisphere. Particularly with the freedom of, you know, thinking of Jamaica, the Bahamas, and a number of other places. But then, of course, that moved to January 1st, which was Emancipation Day, the day that the Emancipation Proclamation. But the Juneteenth holiday is arisen as a kind of a popular holiday that had no official recognition outside of Texas for a long time, but has finally become a national holiday. I'd be quick to point out that July 5th is a day that New York should celebrate the emancipation in New York State as well, because that is the day on which slavery ended in New York State in 1827.
And so we're running out of time. Less than a minute left. I understand you get a July 4th event. Give us a quick, you know, what's happening at 194 Livingston Avenue on Saturday, June 18th. And if people want more information.
Yeah, if they want more information about the Juneteenth program, they can go to our website, undergroundrailroadhistory.org. They can also think about the July 4th program that we're having, where we're going to have Mayor Kamel Johnson from the city of Hudson, an African-American mayor, elected mayor in the city of Hudson. So he'll be speaking on being a change maker. And we certainly welcome everybody to participate in that.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Paul Stewart of the Underground Railroad Education Center. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Again, that event will be held on Saturday, June 18th at 194 Livingston Ave, Albany, For more information, undergroundrailroadhistory.org. On Wednesday, June 8th, 2022, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry met with labor leaders Ibrahim Pedrinian, president of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor, and former president Bill Ritchie in front of the Starbucks Latham store. They celebrated the victory of Latham and Stuyvesant Plaza's workers who voted to form a union. In this labor segment, Willie Terry spoke to them about the importance of the union vote. This is part three of this interview.
You know, we had the $15 movement, you know, get people to pay $15. Due to the inflation and things that Abraham just talked about, don't you think that movement now would have to be more than $15 a movement in order to for people to have a living wage?
Oh, I would agree with that, absolutely.
I mean, I was saying 20 for 2020, you know, like yeah, this was absolutely. A couple of years before, you know, when they were really making the push in like 2016, 2017, 2018. I said, what are you people talking about? $15 an hour, like that's a pittance. If I mean, I think there was a report from the New York Times, and this was 4 years ago, that said if wages would have kept up with labor productivity, minimum wage would have been $18.36 an hour. So the fight for 15 is already below the mark. Well, you can't do any negotiating, you can't do any sort of like actual change if you're already shooting below the target. It doesn't make any sense. So, you know, we have to come up, you know, eventually. I mean, I would hope that 25 by 2025 would be a new rallying cry, you know, $25 an hour as a minimum wage by 2025. Who knows?
You know, one of the questions that people are asking, and you clarified it, is that each Starbucks is voting to form a union. But is there a collective effort to form that, you know, like National Starbucks Union, where, you know, all Starbucks could be involved?
From my understanding, it's tricky. I think there's like a tipping point where I think we're at 135 unionized Starbucks out of 8,000 in the United States. So I think that, you know, eventually we'll probably reach a tipping point where there may be some sort of something, but you know, it's hard to say how, you know, how the national project versus these smaller projects. I mean, you know, Starbucks, whenever there's an intention to unionize or organize, you know, Starbucks is like, well, the bargaining unit is the district. Well, that's maybe, you know, 15 stores, and if only one store is ready for its vote, that means 14 stores, you know, you're jeopardizing the vote because not all those 14 stores have been organized. So I think that at a certain level creates, you know, kind of a tricky situation in terms of navigating what's going on. I mean, if all Starbucks decided all in one day to, like, go on strike nationwide, I think maybe we would see maybe a movement or a moment to make a shift. But at this point, we're building brick by brick into the foundation of something that may or may not turn into a national Starbucks union.
So organizing Starbucks right now, what do you see as the future groups that need to be organized? Or that you make it reach out to?
I think Bill's got a lot more history on this one, so I'm going to turn it over to Bill.
I think there's a sort of very encouraging development a couple of weeks back where the workers in Troy at St. Joseph's House, presented evidence that the majority of the workers wanted to unionize, right? And from what I understand, that request was denied by the management. They want to go to election, they want to go through a formal process, that sort of stuff, right? But I think that for a lot of, I think one of the areas in which we have to think about it would be certainly human services, and this type of human services, sort of agencies. I mean, and particularly occupations which deal with children and things like that. I mean, people who work in daycare centres are really, truly oppressed in terms of their salaries, right? I mean, we're not in the 30s. We're not in the 40s or the 50s. We're dealing with a different economic model, in a sense, a different form of capitalism, if you would have it that way. This is not industrial capitalism. It's sort of merchant capitalism. It's a different type of capitalism, and it's a lot harder to pin down. You know what I'm saying? I mean, in the 30s, it was fairly clear who the enemy was. And it was easy to identify the enemy and easy to fight against the enemy. But things are so diffuse right now, it's just harder, very much harder, to understand what direction to take. But I'm not really sure how to answer that question.
Because I'm saying that you have major organizations like supermarkets.
Right.
You know, a lot of supermarkets, and they are building, and they got a lot of employees.
Mm-hmm.
And we know we still got Walmarts, a lot of Walmarts right here. And, you know, McDonald's.
Right,
different groups. And, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that we reach out that we, if you organize them, that will help build the labor movement.
Right.
But I guess because of the grip that management have on those groups, that they are hard to organize.
Right.
I think the service industry is a really interesting kind of moment, because you are very much like in close proximity with a large group of people. So like, in terms of, you know, if you're in an office cubicle, that might be a little trickier. But you know, the service industry, you're behind the counter. You're kind of a captive audience of sorts. I think those are really going to be an important place to turn our energy. I think, like you're both saying, like kind of big box kind of type spaces. So whether that's a Walmart, a Target, a grocery store, a warehouse. I mean, I think those are really, even though we're seeing a lot of those kinds of things, like stores going away, right? And everyone's just going online. Warehouses all the more, I think, are going to be important. And supermarkets. You know, one of the areas of a lot of deregulation and exploitation right now, of course, is the the Ubers and the Lyfts and the like DoorDash and like these kind of like little like services where you feel like you're making money, but really, like, at the end of the day, you know, you're making subpar wages. You might feel like you made an extra $30, but when you take that, you know, per hour, and then you take that, you know, divided by mileage and divided by this and by that, you know, you've actually, you know, your insurance, your health, you know, all of those things, because they're put back on you. And it's one of the clever things that the bosses have done, is now, you know, doing a lot of contractor kind of, instead of employees, they're contractors, and so now all of the liability is on you and none of it's on the boss, even though the boss is raking in, you know, buco bucks. And I think that's got to be like a mind shift for workers, to be like, no, I'm an employee, and no, I deserve X, Y, or Z things. And I think we have to, like, part of our messaging has to remind those kind of gig economy workers, so to speak, of, you know, of their, not only their rights, but, you know, what they can win when they fight back.
Okay. You know, just one last question, you know. And I want to thank you for, you know, this interview, you know, and a lot more questions that I have, but, you know, down the line, we'll get to those. So I want to get back to the Starbucks question. So why are you here at this particular Starbucks today, and what's next?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, I mean, why we're here today, we've built a relationship. And I think that's one of the things that is super, super crucial within the labor movement, is to remind these folks, you know, not just like, oh, we supported you up until your vote and now we're gone, now we're disappearing. It's super important to remind folks that we're here, we're strong, we're not going anywhere, we're your family. And that, you know, very specifically for this location here at Latham Plaza, you know, that they know that when it comes time for their bargaining and their negotiating, that they have allies and friends and family that can, in the labor movement, that can show up. Incidentally, this location is right in between the Public Employees Federation and the New York State United Teachers and IBEW, Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Like, so it's a huge kind of conglomeration of labor unions around here, And some of them have shown up and shown, you know, consistent support, and we appreciate that for sure. And so just making sure that that support is continuous. This afternoon, we're going to head over to celebrate the 134th birthday of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor, June 8, 1888. And also to celebrate, of course, the victory of the Stuyvesant Plaza workers in their huge victory, their landslide 15-0 knockout takedown of the bosses over there. So we'll be you know, continuing our efforts there. Once we hear of any other Starbucks organized, you know, we want to make sure that we're showing up for them. We're also going to keep showing up for Joseph's House over in Troy, for the Skidmore non-tenure track faculty. These campaigns that are coming about right now, we're, you know, these are exciting campaigns. I just got a super secret on the DL call the other day that I can't talk about, but another campaign that's like super duper 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 exciting. And so, you know, we'll definitely rally folks when that goes public. So, you know, our goal, I think, is to just remain supportive, to keep building the relationships, to recognize that these are all our new family members, and we've got to protect each other, because we are always stronger together.
That is the third part of this interview. To hear more, go to our website, mediasanctuary.org/stories. For those just tuning in, I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge Muncie Community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Now, at the Juneteenth 2022 screening of the feature film Sunshine Circle, clinical psychologist Dr. Sonia Ann Miller discusses issues of trauma and resilience with Marcia Reeves. Writer and producer of the film, which tells her own story, here Dr. Miller talks with Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Kathy Sleeber about trauma and resilience in the context of Juneteenth.
It's Juneteenth, and all kinds of events are bringing the community together with celebration, with reflection. One particular topic to visit on Juneteenth is trauma, and personal trauma, childhood trauma, and historical trauma that is experienced through generations. I'm so pleased to welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine Dr. Sonia Ann Miller, a clinical psychologist who teaches at HVCC, SUNY Albany, and College of St. Rose, who has one of her many specialties is African-American psychology. She's actually developed a whole course in this, and she's here today to make those connections for us between trauma and well-being, and especially at this time of community celebration and welcoming of a reckoning with Juneteenth. Welcome, Dr. Miller. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. All right. So, I will be discussing on Saturday, after the showing of the film, The Sunshine Circle, the link between the different types of childhood trauma and our social well-being, emotional well-being, political well-being, all of that, and bringing attention to some research that has been done on adverse childhood experiences. We call them ACEs. So these ACEs occur before a child's 18th birthday. This particular study examined the 10 most common types of childhood trauma. That's what they were measuring. And five of those are personal: physical abuse, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect, emotional neglect. And five are related to family members. So mental illness, divorce of parents, a parent who's an alcoholic, a mother or father who's a victim of domestic violence, a family member in jail. So each type of trauma counts as one. Now, you know, easily for myself, for example, I, you know, had a mother who was physically and sexually abused, diagnosed with mental illness, divorced from my biological father, who was an alcoholic, drug addict, and also was in jail. That puts me at six. This is a very high number. It also increases my risk for, you know, higher inflammatory responses, chronic illness, among other things, depression, alcoholism. Now those are the most common. There are, of course, many other types of childhood trauma. And in the movie, The Sunshine Circle, our heroine, you know, experiences bullying. She experiences personal injury, severe personal injury. But there's racism. You could watch a sibling be abused. You could lose a caregiver, such as your grandmother, your grandfather. You could live in poverty or experience homelessness. So, you know, these things count as traumas. And this toxic, I guess, stress when one does experience these adverse childhood experiences damages the structure and the function of a child's developing brain, right? This is something that we clearly see through the film. And there's a direct link between childhood trauma and adult onset of chronic disease, adult onset of depression, suicide, being violent, or a victim of violence, right? So the more trauma we accumulate in our lives, and I think, unfortunately, in the African-American community, you know, there's a history of an accumulation of traumas. There's a history of household dysfunction, substance abuse, criminal behavior, you know, parental separation, divorce, mental illness, having a parent being battered, having a battered mother. So all of these types of trauma increase the risk of health, social, and emotional problems. Our health problems are the coronary pulmonary lung disease that a lot of African Americans experience, hepatitis. Then when you look at how children can be overloaded with stress hormones, you can see why they're in the flight, fright, or freeze mode. This is just physiological. But what does it lead to? It leads to problems with learning in school, difficulty trusting adults, difficulty developing healthy relationships with peers. Some become loners. All of this creates anxiety. And what do we do with all of that anxiety? Well, sometimes we turn to cigarettes to reduce anger. You know, cigarettes also increase focus, it relieves depression, alcohol relieves stress. But all of these are bad choices, unfortunately. And, you know, even high-risk sports, risky sexual behavior, sometimes overworking, overachieving, that's also a mode that we get into. I can speak to that personally. So it's important to have positive childhood experiences. And the knowledge of both ACEs and these PCEs, we're going to call that PACE. Right? The knowledge of all of that, you know, helps us understand why we behave we do, why we have certain coping behaviors, but these coping behaviors are normal because they're a normal response to abnormal circumstances. So the positive childhood experiences count. No matter how much adversity you've had in your life, if you can ask yourself if you were in your childhood or early adulthood able to talk about your feelings? Did you have a family that stood beside you? Did you celebrate community traditions such as the one we're having this weekend? Did you have a sense of belonging? Did you get support from your friends? Two non-parent adults in your life that took an interest in you, very important. And then just feeling safe, feeling protected by an adult in your home. So knowledge of PACE is important because we want to increase family resilience. We want to increase family connection so that children can flourish.
This is such important information. This is in such important knowledge, and this is what the screening and the discussion will bring to the Troy community on Saturday. And this is only one of many ways to get this information out there, because what you're saying, the highlights here are a few. It's physiological. It's neurological. It is the way the human physiology is designed to work in situations of profound threat and overload. The fact that people then develop compensatory behaviors trying to regulate a profoundly dysregulated nervous system, especially when it's been dysregulated in childhood, and as you crucially point out, has gone right down Main Street of the development of the brain, not to mention the sort of behaviors and then the ways those behaviors are responded to. And then I have to say, I mean, every human body will have these responses, but then you put it into a climate of racism, of children's needs being overlooked and inadequately addressed in communities where scarcity prevails, scarcity of all kinds of necessary resources, and people make judgments. People say, oh, well, you know, I certainly didn't make those choices. I certainly never, you know. It's like, yeah, well, you maybe had the good fortune to grow up without very many ACEs and a wealth of PACEs, and you were physiologically equipped to go out and be in the world in that way. The final point, I'm just putting a highlight, a spotlight on your points, good. And that is a feeling of safety.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I don't know that people can imagine what it's like to feel profoundly threatened in every lived moment. And then the question to society is, okay, what are we going to do about this?
But at the organizational level, at the community level, we definitely need to create more healing-centered environments, even healing-centered work environments and programs.
Thank you, Dr. Sonia Ann Miller, for joining us. Dr. Miller discusses these issues after the Juneteenth screening of the film Sunshine Circle, Saturday, June 18th at 10 a.m. at HVCC. I'm Kathy Silber for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
The screening for the Sunshine Cafe is at Hudson Valley Community College on June 18th at 10 a.m. For more information, visit our website, mediasanctuary.org.
And so next up, Sina Basilehecki spoke with Angeline Bellor about the MDOCS program at Skidmore.
My name is Angela Beeler, and I'm the documentarian in community co-creation at MDOCS, which is the John B. Moore Documentary Studies Collaborative at Skidmore College.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. In your bio, you begin by describing yourself as a visual artist exploring memory, history, and politics. And I'd love to begin by hearing a little bit more about your own work.
My background is in photography and video and documentary. I do still do some documentary work, but I more use documentary strategies within projects that I work on. And I think the best way to answer your question is to describe some projects that I've done. I often work with historical themes and exploring our relationship to that history. How do we remember it? How does it live in our consciousness, our discourse, our way of looking at being, experiencing, shaping the world now? For instance, in 2019, I directed and produced a performance work, I Want a Baby, which was originally a play written by Sergei Tretyakov in the 1920s as a Soviet-era play. And I created a collaborative queer feminist iteration of this play. And so, you know, it sort of explores themes coming out of the Soviet time period in terms of thinking about household labor and the labor of, you know, creating and envisioning a new society. And through that distance and distance culturally, distance in time, distance geographically, think about how these themes emanate in our world now. I also have been working on a project called 1996 East 9th Street, which came out of looking at the FBI files that my father acquired through a FOIA request, where he became very active in the protest movement against the Vietnam War in the mid-1960s. And the FBI began surveilling my grandparents' home in Homecrest, which is a South Brooklyn neighborhood. And so what I'm putting together is a kind of multimedia exploration of dissent during that time period and how it relates to family, family home, intergenerational exchange in terms of my own involvement in political movement. And this looks at the kind of personal and political ways that we can look at the movements of dissent in the 60s and how it relates to today.
That is very interesting. So you're now working in this really interesting space, co-creation initiative. But before we get into that, what can you tell our listeners about MDocs?
So MDocs is a documentary studies program at Skidmore College, which is in Saratoga Springs. And I started here in March, so I'm fairly new. We are affiliated in many ways with the Media and Film Studies Department, but focus more specifically on documentary. We don't have a major or a minor, but students take classes both in production and also thinking about documentary. And so we have DocLab, where students can work within DocLab during a semester and volunteer, take on different tasks related to either faculty classes or in terms of the work that I do, community partners who might have events to be documented, editing that could be done. So the co-creation initiative started prior to my arrival at MDocs. It was delayed because of COVID, but it was a grant-based initiative funded by the Mellon Foundation to support collaborations between community organizations and faculty and staff at Skidmore College on nonfiction storytelling projects, documentary projects. These are sparked by the work and the stories of the community partners, and then faculty and staff can find out about them and then become involved in various ways in those collaborations. And that has really become a heart of what MDocs is doing and has involved a lot of student engagement, engagement in faculty classes, and has really continued this reach from the campus community out into the broader Saratoga Springs and Capital District region.
When you were describing your own work earlier with memory and lineage, it really reminded me of my conversation with Paulette Moore. I heard the common threads between how you were describing your work and how Paulette works in her work, and having worked with various Indigenous communities, which is very much about lineage and passing down knowledge, how do you take the work that you've been doing and bring it into this work of reaching out to these different initiatives and communities for the co-creation initiative?
Mm-hmm. Finding this job listed for facilitating the co-creation initiative was really amazing because it brings together all kinds of elements that come out of my own life work. I, you know, have been a kind of community organizer, activist for much of my life. I was raised by parents who were politically engaged. I grew up with that. I took that up as a very young person. And I think a big piece of that is building connections, is, you know, listening to the goals, visions, and dreams of people that I'm working in collaboration with, and thinking about, well, how can we make that happen? Who can we connect to? Who might know that, you know, this or that about whatever it is that they're looking for? So there's that element. And then I was working in video and photo and writing, and there's always like a storytelling component in that. And over the past like 5 or 6 years, I've turned towards performance, engaging in other artists' collaborative performance work, queer collaborative performance, you know, collaboratively telling stories together that might end up in a video work, and then producing my own collaborations. And so that collaboration itself, we all do it. You can't really, I think, live without collaborating with other people in some capacity. That might be one other person, it might be your family, it might be, you know, with your with friends. But thinking about how we work together, how do we communicate, how do we bring together either disparate goals and visions or similar goals and visions together, so that, you know, we can make something anew out of those visions coming together. And then I think there's a kind of scrappiness that I bring to this, where, and what I mean by that is that with art making, with activism, with organizing, it's kind of, you know, you start from the bare minimum that you bring to something, and how can I make the most out of this? And also just kind of being nimble, like each of these projects I'm working now with, nearly 9 different collaborations, they all are a different output, different questions. So it's just kind of listening and being attentive to the needs, and saying, this is where I can help. This is somebody else I can connect you with. Who could answer this question? Let's like reach out. The other piece of it is that, you know, we're working to extend resources out from the campus community to support off-campus projects, which also brings back resource to the campus, because each of these groups bring, you know, a wealth of knowledge and information from the work that they do. But it means a bit of like, well, you know, how can we make this work?
Thank you so much, Angela Bielor, for joining me on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Are there any events coming up, and how can listeners find more information?
We don't necessarily have upcoming events, but I do think it's useful to know some of the groups that we're working with. And they have all of their own, you know, projects and events that are happening. Some of your listeners will likely be familiar with Lights Out Norlight. We've been supporting them. We're working with Black Dimensions in Art, which is the oldest Black arts organization in New York State, outside of New York City. We're working with Indakina Education Center, which is based up here, and they have language classes in Abenaki language. They have summer camps for youth, and we will be supporting a visiting storytellers and artists series in the fall related to Dr. Siobhan Hart's anthropology class in the fall. But that will be open for the broader public, kind of extending the Indigenous Media Maker series that just happened. But you can visit our website, www.skidmore.edu/mdocs. And there you will find some, you know, you can navigate alongside to co-creation initiative and other events that we have coming up.
Thank you, Sina, for this segment. And for other stories like this one, go to our website, mediasanctuary.org/stories.
Here we are in the studio with Jody Cohen, who's a Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer, as well as the person who runs the Media Club. Hey, Jody, welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine as a guest.
Happy to be here. Happy to be in the guest seat, right? And live in the studio, right? This is fantastic.
Yeah. Listen, I know we've had a lot of segments from the people who are involved in the Media Club, but why don't you give us a rundown on just exactly what the Media Club is?
Yeah, so this year the program was an extension of the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall's kind of youth education program, arts education program, right? And they partnered with Troy Prep High School to put together a series of clubs that are basically after-school clubs for the Troy Prep High School student body, right? Kind of part of the school day, but before they leave for the school day. So it was various clubs between volleyball club and guitar club and music club and chess club, outdoor exploration club. I was commissioned on behalf of the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall and the Sanctuary for Independent Media as the teaching artist to lead media club. And in my class, our class, we focused on media literacy. We were looking at headlines and what goes into a news production, looking at really an introductory level, what it is that we're consuming media-wise and what goes into that, breaking down some of the messaging in some of the media that we consume on a regular basis, whether that's coming from the news, social media, just everything that part involves. And then we got into producing media ourselves, looking at what goes into an interview, different techniques of voice, commanding your voice, taking control of your voice. And really the biggest part and the biggest highlight was just talking to young people and giving them an opportunity to voice their interest, express themselves, and just kind of give words and feeling to their thoughts in an opportunity where I feel like they didn't have that a lot.
Well, when you say media club, I know you did some audio, some radio stuff. Did you touch upon other forms of media, or is this just a general approach to how you communicate?
It started off in an interesting way where we weren't sure if we were going to do at the very beginning, if it was going to be, it was almost broken up into two classes. We were going to do a video production class and a radio production class. And then we presented that idea to the student body. And I think that there was more excitement for the idea of the radio production. And I think people, at least the student body, was thinking about podcasting. And I think that they were looking at podcasting as a medium. And I think that level of talking on microphones and being able to just kind of express whatever topics interest them, I think that piece is what kind of pulled more people in. So we kind of pivoted into focusing on that aspect of audio production, radio production. And again, with the Sanctuary for Independent Media being one of the kind of umbrella organizers for this particular club, the idea was that we have an outcome that we could have radio produced pieces that would be ready for this program, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Yeah, we have. We've had quite a few. How many, when did this start as far as the year goes? Was it a full year-long thing? I know it's recently finished.
Yeah.
And how many students were involved?
It was a wild year of missed opportunities and different things that just happened from the school year. That was really, so it was supposed to start in the fall. I think it was, I started planning, and I think the first lesson plan was around August, and we were going to start in September. I think because of COVID stuff, right, and because of just uncertainty about how the program was going to run on a larger scale, with Troy Prep High School being in itself a bit of a new program, and it's running, this is now 2.0 Troy Prep High School, and they're doing their new thing and them trying to figure out how this was all going to work. We didn't end up starting until a few months into the school year. So that was like kind of the first hurdle. We got a bit of a delayed start, and then just trying to figure out, how to use the time. So it would be like 45-minute classes 4 days a week to kind of get this in. So now this was essentially about the school year, Monday through Thursday after school is what they were doing there.
But they come to media club how many times a week?
They would come. I would have essentially two groups that kind of became one group 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday,
really?
And Thursday.
For the whole year?
Yeah.
Oh, and they enjoyed it.
They were really great. And I feel like there was the mix of kids there. The Troy Prep High School is a predominantly African-American student body. My particular class was a really pretty balanced mix of types of people, genders and racial backgrounds and family kind of backgrounds, and just all, everybody was different, right? And an interesting thing for me meeting these young people was that I didn't go to a prep school. I went to a public school, so the idea of these students that were in uniforms and this kind of regimented, I don't want to say militaristic, but it's very strict as far as the protocols, and they're this academic excellence is what they're striving for in this very kind of pressurized way. And being able to have an opportunity for these kids to just really express themselves individually and shine a little bit on how each one of them was an individual, you know, just like that, focusing on each of them and getting their stories out and how they could kind of shine was really the highlight of that. And I think very quickly they all came out of their shells on the first week, as far as like, this is me, this is my personality, this is how I stand out. And so it was kind of my job just to rein that in, to be like, okay, how do we focus this energy on whatever this interesting topic is that you might like here?
So in terms of the topics and how they chose them, how did each student go into choosing their own topics that they were going to talk about, producing for our show, producing stories, you know, of so on and so forth?
Yeah, it was an interesting bit of extraction that we had to do, right, as far as just like, you know, really just started with just asking questions first. That was just like, hey, what is it that you are interested in? And then kind of narrowing down these questions in a way that was like, all right, we'll go around the room a couple of times. And the comfort level of being like, okay, this is what I'm into, this is what I want to share about, and this is what I want to talk about on a microphone was a bit of a slow process for some of them, as far as like, this is like really what I'm excited about. But I think once they, being able to talk to each other, and I feel like my job really was to get myself out of the way so that I could just be like, hey, this is about you guys talking to each other, hearing yourselves. And once one person heard at least one other person interested in their interest, I think it was like this exponential thing of like, yeah, you know what, this does have merit. I can be more excited about this thing. We talked about and we looked at everything as far as kind of, we started with the school, what's going on in the school that we can kind of focus on. And then we were looking at what's going on in the neighborhood that we can kind of focus on. What's going on at home? Who can you talk to at home that's of interest that you maybe never talked to? Interviewing your parents, interviewing your neighbors, this kind of thing. Interviewing somebody, a teacher at school, about what you're interested in. With this idea of being a larger part, or becoming and exploring a larger connection to the community. You know, what's happening around you that's newsworthy? Who can we talk to? Where are these stories that are happening all around us that we're just not tapping into, right? And expressing and exploring that. Hope that answers
that
your question.
Sounds absolutely amazing. Now, is going to happen again next year?
I think so. I'd like to think so. I know that it seems that the high school is going through changes. I think, from what I understand, that Troy Prep High School itself is going to be absorbed into another school. So I don't know what's happening with the program. I don't know what's going on there, but I would be happy to be involved again. The student group was really fantastic. That age group is really great. Any platform that I can kind of be involved in, of just getting young people or really anybody to kind of voice something that they feel like they can't share, I'm into, and I'm all about supporting.
So if someone wants to find out more, I mean, like if someone's at home and they've got children, these kids are what, high school age?
Yeah,
so if they're interested, can they approach somebody? Or
I mean, for more information on our Media Sanctuary website, mediasanctuary.org, there is a column that focuses on what we're calling Youth Sanctuary. And then from there, there's tabs to follow the kind of the couple of years that we did with the Media Club specifically, and other youth programs that we do here. I know we have, I think, an Uptown Summer program that we do here that's young people getting involved with media production and that kind of thing. There's a ton of great youth programs involving media in the Capital District, and I'm hoping to get involved with some myself.
Well, that's great. Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, great.
And thank you for the important work you're doing, inspiring children. Thank you for joining us, Jody.
And that concludes our show. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Conliff.
And I'm Kaelin McPherson, also your engineer for tonight. Our content is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. We want to hear from you. How do you experience the Hudson Mohawk Magazine? What resonates with you most? What could we do better? Share your info with us on our social media page on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Media Sanctuary.
And thanks for tuning in.